This episode is brought to you by Odd Mo's Pizza in Canby. Handmade awesome pizza plus craft beer, cider, and wine delivered. Call them today at 503-266-8444.
This episode is also brought to you by the Canby Liquor Store. Yep, they're still open. There's no scientific evidence that says that alcohol cures COVID, but hey, it's worth a shot, am I right? Find them at the Canby Fred Meyer Shopping Center. Welcome to the Canby Now podcast,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Well, it's official. 2020 is the absolute worst. Oregon Governor Kate Brown shared the difficult news during a press conference Thursday that she will not be lifting her restrictions on large gatherings, including sporting events, concerts, festivals, and conventions, until a reliable treatment or prevention is found for COVID-19.
The Oregon Health Authority is advising that any large gathering, at least through September, should either be canceled or significantly modified. I know this is really, really hard. I too will miss visiting our fairs and our festivals this year.
Many large events this summer have already been canceled, including the Spring Garden Fair, Clackamas Kennel Club Shows, Bigfoot Festival, and Taste and Tunes, while the Oregon Renaissance Fair was postponed until September. Following the governor's announcement, the sad news broke that Hairfest, Slice of Summer, and the Canby 4th of July fireworks show would all be canceled, with more likely to come. No formal announcements have yet been made regarding Canby's Independence Day celebration, the Swan Island Dahlia Fest, and Canby's Big Night Out. The Clackamas County Fair and Canby Rodeo also have not been officially canceled, though many others were this week, including the St. Paul Rodeo, Malala Buckaroo, and Oregon State Fair. The state's summer fair season is over before it even began. At the press conference, the governor also shared new details of her framework for reopening Oregon's economy, including guidance for counties and businesses on the phased reopening process. Recently, Governor Brown lifted her order delaying non-urgent medical procedures, with safeguards in place for healthcare workers and patients, announced the limited reopening of some of the state's outdoor parks and recreation areas. This did not include Malala River State Park in Canby. This week, she said her office will issue updated safety guidelines regarding transit, certain childcare, summer school, and summer camps and youth programs will be issued. Each step of the reopening process is contingent on Oregonians following the safety guidelines for each sector.
But let me be very clear. These choices are not easy. As we reopen parts of our economy, we know and expect that there may be an uptick in new coronavirus cases. That's why we have to be prepared in every single corner of the state, because as we've seen, an outbreak can occur anywhere in the state. Reopening any part of our state also comes with risk. This virus is still very dangerous, and it still poses a great threat. Until there is a vaccine, unfortunately, we will not be able to go back to life as we knew it. Not here in Oregon, or frankly anywhere. I know this can be a really tough reality to face.
Her new guidance on reopening calls for the widespread use of face coverings, maintaining physical distance of 6 feet between individuals as much as possible, and following good hygiene and disinfection practices. She thanked Oregonians for following the state's strict physical distancing guidelines over the past several weeks and said they have successfully flattened the curve of COVID-19 cases and prevented thousands of infections. There are now fewer than 100 COVID-19 hospitalizations in the state. Oregon has established plans for increasing testing capacity, expanding contact tracing capability, and building reserves of personal protective equipment. Now, some counties will be eligible to begin the limited reopening of additional business sectors beginning as early as May 15th if they have demonstrated they have met all prerequisites for reopening. These counties must show a decline in COVID-19 cases or have fewer than 5 hospitalizations. They must also have sufficient testing and contact tracing capability, establish plans for the isolation and quarantine of new cases, have the hospital capacity to handle any surge in new cases, and have enough personal protective equipment for healthcare workers. Under the first phase, counties can begin the limited reopening of the following sectors: restaurants and bars for sit-down service, personal care and service businesses, including barbers and salon, and in-person gatherings of up to 25 people. All of these fall under new specific safety guidelines tailored to each sector. Counties must remain in phase 1 for at least 21 days before becoming eligible to advance to phase 2. If counties begin to see significant increases in COVID-19 cases or community spread, OHA will work with the local public health officials to determine if the county should move back from phase 1 to a stay-at-home status. As you just heard, Governor Kate Brown on Thursday provided more information on the 7 prerequisites counties must meet before they can begin the first phase of reopening certain businesses affected by the COVID-19 shutdowns. Those criteria include a declining rate of confirmed cases, a testing capacity of at least 30 tests per 10,000 residents each day, an adequate supply of PPE and hospital capacity to handle a spike in cases, and a robust team of contact tracers to track each person who tests positive for COVID-19 has come into contact with to limit the spread. The number of contact tracers each county must have is based on population. Although the final numbers have not yet been released, it is estimated that Clackamas County will need to retain between 50 and 60 for the job, about 4 times as many as their public health department currently has on track to handle infectious diseases, including STDs. Those counties who meet the criteria and have their plans approved by Governor Brown and the OHA, or Oregon Health Authority, may begin reopening as early as this week. But Clackamas County will not be among them. According to a statement Friday, we are at least 2 weeks from being ready. A statement from the county on Friday read, quote, "We are working on the phase 1 plan to submit to Governor Brown. But this is challenging due to our county's size and unique makeup. Per the governor's guidelines, we must first reach established goals with contact tracing, a decrease in the prevalence of the virus, and hospital admission data. We are at least a couple of weeks away from meeting these prerequisites." Although much of the responsibility for meeting the reopening criteria rests with the counties and their leaders, Clackamas County says there are things that businesses, city government, and even individual citizens can now do to help accelerate the process, or at least be ready when the time comes. "We ask residents to continue to abide by the governor's order to ensure the progress we have made against the virus is not lost," the county says. "We encourage local businesses to review the governor's plans and adhere to the required guidelines to help Clackamas County reopen. Thus, our local mayors need to hear from their businesses about preparation plans prior to planned openings. The county understands that people want to return to normal as quickly as possible. Their statement said, quote, "We must all work together collaboratively to avoid a future spike in infections." The latest information on the reopening process in Clackamas County can be found on the county's website at clackamas.us/coronavirus. After a Canby resident was visited by local police last weekend based on reports, later confirmed, that it was open for dine-in service in violation of the governor's executive order, those wanting to support the restaurant owner's decision decided to, quote, dine out on Saturday. They brought camp chairs, utensils, and in some cases even their own picnic tables, and they enjoyed their takeout meals in the parking lot and sidewalks outside of the beloved local restaurant, Pappy's Greasy Spoon. Among them were Canby business owner Christopher Foster and his 10-year-old daughter, Matea. He said he was there to, quote, "support a local business and to stick it to the government. It's a message that we want businesses like his, and we want them to be able to open," he said of Pappy's and owner Mike Merrill's decision 1 week ago to open in defiance of the governor's orders. "We need more businesses like him to do what he did," end quote. Foster said he would have preferred to eat inside the diner. Governor Brown's orders do not specifically prohibit eating outdoors, but he happened to have a card table. They set it up near Pappy's front door and shared a Denver omelet, pancakes, and potatoes with country gravy. Being in the furniture delivery business, he's very used to all varieties of takeout food, he explained. They washed it down with some water they brought in a gallon jug. "I've eaten here a couple times," Foster said. "The food is great and the portions are," he chuckled, "more than enough." Inside, all of the rules were observed. Orders were being taken by phone or at the door, chairs were stacked on tables, and those waiting for takeout were limited to no more than six at a time. Most patrons chose to wait outside. Their names were called from the front door when their orders were ready. Reached later in the day, Merrill said Saturday had been a much busier day than usual for the little diner, which, like many other restaurants and small businesses, is struggling to stay afloat in the midst of the COVID-related shutdowns. When officers arrived the previous Saturday, Merrill reportedly told them that finances had motivated his decision to open for full service. He said, quote, "the to-go meals were not cutting it and he has bills to pay," end quote. When Governor Brown extended school closures through the end of the academic year, Canby High School tentatively rescheduled graduation ceremonies from June 5th to July 17th in the hopes that the stay-at-home orders might be relaxed by then. That was appearing increasingly unlikely in recent days, and Principal Greg Denza told the Canby Now podcast on Monday of last week that the administration team had already begun planning for a virtual ceremony. Sad expectation became reality on Thursday when Governor Brown announced she would not be lifting her restrictions on large gatherings until at least October. Later that day, Principal Denza sent an email to seniors and families confirming that this year's graduation ceremony would be unlike anything they would have imagined prior to COVID-19 becoming a household word. "We're all disappointed with how our school year and your careers at Canby High School have ended," he said. "The COVID-19 closures have been disruptive to our personal lives and those of our community as a whole." While the staff at CHS has worked hard to celebrate our seniors and make your transition as smooth as possible, missing out on the final rites of passage can never be replicated or replaced. "We've decided to move forward with a virtual graduation ceremony," the principal continued. "Unlike some of the hastily organized events that you may have seen, we are planning a graduation experience that will culminate in a professionally produced video available to all. This experience will include seniors attending filming sessions with up to four family members. They'll also be participating in other celebratory activities the admin team is coordinating based on feedback from the class of 2020 about what parts of graduation festivities they most want to preserve. If gathering constraints are lifted earlier than expected, the school will plan a post-graduation event at a later date. Our vision is to host a Class of 2020 reception at CHS, where we will recognize our seniors and families, Dinza said. While it will not have the formality of our traditional graduation ceremony, it will provide us the opportunity to collectively celebrate our seniors. While not the desired outcome, he admitted, school officials believe a high-quality virtual graduation ceremony is an appropriate and worthy alternative, given the difficult circumstances. When the homemade mask craze hit a few weeks ago, with volunteers churning out dozens of cloth masks for local senior care facilities, food banks, retail stores, and anyone else who might need one, Martin Lackner wanted to do his part. Only problem was, the Persian Gulf War Marine veteran didn't have a sewing machine handy. So, like any resourceful military man, he made do with what he had, a 3D printer. 3D printers can't make face coverings, but they can make something just as important for those who have to wear them for hours at a time, ear savers. These simple plastic devices loop around the back of the head or neck and keep the elastic bands from rubbing on the ears. Lackner, who's also the commander of the Canby Aurora Veterans of Foreign Wars post, has printed more than 1,000 ear savers, and he's given them all away for free. He and a helper distribute them locally through non-contact porch pickups, and he's also shipped them all over the state and country. Between me and a few other Portland area printers, we have produced and distributed over 10,000 of them for free, he said. Canby Fire got 35, Seattle Children's Hospital, Lake Oswego Urgent Care, OHSU, Adventist Health, St. Mary's in Michigan, sent some to New York City, New Orleans. The list is long. He got the initial design from an online 3D printing community. But he soon developed his own, one with a larger hole in the center to accommodate a ponytail. Lackner's unique design is more comfortable for those with long hair, but it also helps hold the device in place for easy removal and replacement of a mask. He said he has heard from numerous recipients that the ear savers are, well, a lifesaver. A nurse at Countryside Living said she forgot she's wearing a mask, Lackner said. Others commented that they had burns on their ears from wearing the mask for so long, but they healed up within a few days with the ear savers. Lackner has posted his design online for other 3D printers to download and use for free. If you or a loved one needs an ear saver, contact Lackner on Facebook. For a link and photos, find this story on our website at canbynowpod.com. Canby Now Sports is brought to you by Reif & Hunziker, PC. When you need an attorney, turn to the firm Canby has trusted for over 50 years. Call them today at 503-266-3456. Sports, from the pinnacle of the pros and even the Olympics all the way down to Little League, have ground to a halt due to the coronavirus pandemic. However, it's certain that someday athletes will once again take to the court, the field, and the gridiron to compete. And when that day comes, there are plenty of college football teams around the country who would love to have a Canby Cougar or two on their rosters. One of the most highly prized prospects on the Canby High School football team is current junior Chance Miller, a human highlight reel known for his explosiveness on both sides of the ball. On Saturday, the Three Rivers League first teamer announced he was honored to have received a full ride scholarship offer to play Division I football for the United States Air Force Academy. His coach, Jimmy Joyce, said it won't be the last big offer to come his way. His recruiting is just starting, Joyce said. I believe more offers are to come very soon. I'm very proud of him. He's a special athlete and the best is yet to come. Miller is indeed special, or as he was called in at least one scouting report, an unreal overall athlete who, quote, requires a consistent double team if you hope to contain him. I hear from schools almost daily about Chance and others on the team, Coach Joyce said. The secret is out about the talent we have coming up. Miller has until February to make a decision, and it makes sense to wait and see all the offers that come in before he makes a decision. But you could certainly do worse than joining the Falcons, who are known for their premier offense, the distinctive lightning bolts on their helmets, and for players excelling in academics as well as athletics. Last year, the dynamic receiver not only reeled in 59 catches and piled up 1,127 receiving and rushing yards with 9 touchdowns, top 10 in the state in all three categories, he also maintained a 3.8 GPA. The Air Force Academy offers unbelievable personal opportunity outside of playing Division I football, Coach Joyce said. As I told Chance, the Pac-12 and SEC recruit the best football players in the country. The service academies recruit great football players who are also the best people in the country. And that's Chance. There was huge excitement for the Canby Cougars this season with their reinvigorated offense led by Miller and quarterback Mikey Gibson and their restored team culture and swagger under Coach Joyce, who is in his second year with the team. The Cougs were also going to be moving out of the brutal Three Rivers League to play at least a couple of seasons at 5A with a new crosstown rival in Wilsonville. But some of that excitement has been replaced by uncertainty after Governor Kate Brown announced that she would not lift her ban on large gatherings, including live sporting events with fans, until at least October. She and other public health officials were asked what it might mean for the state's high school and college football seasons, and their answers were non-committal. As a full contact activity, football is a bit behind sports such as golf and tennis in meeting new safety guidelines during the coronavirus era. But Coach is optimistic. We'll have to wait and see, but come fall, I think we'll have a lot of good news to report, he said, at least on the football field. All right, Camby, we have some breaking news for you. At the time of this recording, it was, in fact, Tyler Clawson's birthday. He works week after week to produce these amazing news podcasts that you hear and enjoy to stay informed. So if you see him around town, or, you know, since the world shut down, see him on social media, wish him a big, late, happy birthday and tell him he's awesome.
Canby, DirectLink is here for you. In these troubling times, the last thing anyone should have to worry about is how to stay connected to their loved ones, work, education, and news. The expert staff at DirectLink are all based right here in Canby and are committed to keeping those critical internet, video, and voice connections on and strong for their members. They have signed the Keep Americans Connected pledge from the FCC, which means they have promised to keep students online to continue their studies, local businesses connected to their customers and employees, and all their members virtually in touch with what matters most to them, no matter how far away they may be. So if you have DirectLink as a provider, go ahead and reach out to your loved ones on a traditional telephone, watch a child's home recital over an internet video chat, download your favorite local podcast, I mean, do we even have to ask what it is, or enjoy a favorite movie at home, because DirectLink will keep our friends, neighbors, and local businesses connected, no matter what. We're all in this together.
We'd like to extend our undying gratitude to Canby Now Plus member, Jamathiel Morse. Also, my deepest apologies if I mispronounced your name. Either way, we really appreciate you. We rely on your monthly contributions to continue to do this work that we love. To find out how you can become one of the coolest people in the world, one of our supporters on Patreon, visit canbynowpod.com/plus.
My guest on the Canby Conversation today is Jason Fellman. And Jason, I feel like, initially I was going to ask our producer, Tyler, to do just some sad, like, funeral music to intro this segment. But you just insist on being so positive.
Well, you know, I'm a positive guy. What can I say?
Jason,
I, you know.
Jason Feldman, of course, is the co-owner and co-producer of Hairfest and also of many other live music events and things in the area. And as you, most of the folks listening to this probably know or guessed, Hairfest has been canceled for this year. Its homecoming to the Clackamas County Fairgrounds is going to be delayed until 2021. But Jason, as you mentioned, you're just a positive guy.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, sometimes I just feel like you know, I can't stress about things that I can't control.
Yeah, sure.
And I try to keep perspective too. You know, we mentioned this in our announcement, but it's like this isn't a normal cancellation scenario. You know, an event like ours cancels, you know, that would normally be like a huge deal. But when you put it into context with everything else, we're literally, as I said, one of a bazillion events and concerts and other types of things that are impacted by this. So, you know, it's, you know, I guess there's a little more of a sort of a team effort feel to it.
Right. Right, right. And I appreciate that. And you even mentioned just kind of even folks outside of the live entertainment industry are hurting as well. I mean, we're all kind of experiencing in different segments and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, the live music business is at zero revenue and probably will be for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
And the crazy thing, as crazy as that is, there are probably a lot of industries that can say exactly the same thing. Yeah. That's really wild when you really think about it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, tell us a little bit. I do want to make this broader as well, this discussion, and just kind of talk a little bit more about how folks in that industry are feeling and really how this is going to impact, I think, a lot of us as a society, you know, this long, boring summer we now have ahead of us. First, let's talk about Hairfest and that decision. We had you on the show before, Jason, and we've done a number of stories. We were so excited about this Hairfest 10, you know, the 10-year anniversary, and it was going to be the Clackamas County Fairgrounds. You guys were going to do a hair stock. I mean, there is so much excitement about this year. Obviously, like you said, you're part of this. It wasn't just like a vacuum decision. You know, you're part of this, but still it had to be difficult. It had to be disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, major bummer is the phrase that keeps coming to mind. It is a major bummer.
Yeah.
You know, for all the obvious reasons. And I guess, again, if you're looking for silver linings, you know, I mean, I already begun the process of confirming the exact same bands and the same lineup for next season. Mm-hmm. And I've got almost all of them done already, to be honest. And so I guess the silver lining is that the event, you know, when it does happen, we'll get to do the things we were planning on doing this year, next year. So at least all the work that we've put into it so far isn't for naught.
Sure.
You know, the plans and the relationships that we forged with the fairgrounds and with our sponsors, you know, the deepening of our relationship with the public, you know, through our move into the heart of Cambie, all those things are preserved for next year. So at least it's not like, you know, this kills the event and it's never going to happen event kind of scenario.
Right, right. Well, I know, and I'm sure anyone who has been to Hairfest before would agree with this, but we were out there last year and we did a number of interviews with folks. And what stood out to me was how loyal your following is, that it's really a community or even a family. And that is obviously going to last through this. I'm sure you would agree. And if anything, I think, you know, being denied this thing that everyone is excited about is going to just make people want it so much more. You know, next year, people are going to be so pumped.
Yeah.
Absence makes the heart grow fonder, right?
As a musician, because I'm also, you know, I play in several bands, you know, one of the things I was thinking about was like what that moment is going to be like the first time I get to step on the stage again.
Yeah.
Look out at the crowd and we're all there together. I mean, yeah, you can imagine what that energy is going to be like and how much people are going to appreciate being together in a way that we probably, I mean, I know everybody loved the togetherness of Hairfest and of live music in general, but let's face it. You know, that whole phrase, you don't know what you got till it's gone. I think we're all gaining an additional appreciation for what it's like to gather in large groups and be, and have that energy and enjoy each other's company, you know, doing something fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you nailed it. I've been thinking about that a lot as well, that there was so much stuff in this, in the pre-COVID days that we sort of took for granted, you know, that I think we're going to appreciate so much more, the ability to gather at church, the ability to shake somebody's hand, you know?
Yeah. I think the handshake is over. I think that's going to be, and honestly, man, that's so arcade. We should be going to we should just all adopt the Spock. You know what I mean? That would be awesome.
Yeah. So you're one of the down with handshake crowd.
I'm sort of down with the, whatever we have to do to be healthy crowd.
Well, Jason is officially a germaphobe, and listeners, next time you see him, just give him a big hug.
All can you decide, I actually am a hugger.
I am as well.
And, you know, this won't last forever. It's not the first pandemic the human race is facing. It won't be the last.
True.
And we will get through it.
Yeah, absolutely. So the decision for Hairfest, you probably saw the writing on the wall a little bit, even in advance of the governor's press conference last Thursday.
Yeah, I mean, last week we're like, we started really getting, we really tried to hold out as long as we could, mainly because of the uncertainty. I mean, we've always known that we weren't going to do anything unsafe. And we've also known that we weren't going to do a half-ass event. I'm not interested in getting into some 6 feet apart thing with Hairfest. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. if we can, now that doesn't preclude us from maybe trying something completely different this summer. You know, if the stars align and there's some safe way to do live music, you know, we might explore that, Joan and I, or with some of our partners, but we're not going to do Hairfest the way, you know, it won't be hair. It can't be Hairfest. If you can't high five and rock out together, you can't have Hairfest. You know, that's what it is. It's not just about the music. It's equally about the community, about being together. That's right. What people value in the experience.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that, and this is probably a good opportunity to expand it a little bit, because I saw your partner, Joan Monin, her post acknowledging this announcement, last Thursday when folks are listening to this. And Joan Monin of the Wild Hair, she said that, you know, it's so disappointing, obviously, just for its own sake. But at this time when it would really be great if we could get together, right? We kind of need that as a society.
I know.
Don't you?
Right,
like
I know.
The time when we maybe need it most is the one time we can't do it. Do you feel that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I've got a little ambivalence on that topic. I mean, I would argue that we always need to be together.
Yeah.
And this is hard, in different ways in different scenarios. And so, I mean, to be honest, it's a struggle for adults. It's a lot worse for kids. That's, which we don't have anything to do with as a festival. But if I was to sort of, break this down to a human level, the biggest problem right now is kids not being able to be together with their friends. I mean,
yeah,
we're all grown-ups. I mean, you know, people take 6 month sabbaticals and go to the mountains and they come back and they rejoin the world. So, there are precedents for, individuals being able to check out for a while. You just never had anything in society like this.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good call. My wife and I have been really talking about and looking at our 4-year-old this past week. And my wife, she's a healthcare worker, and she's like, I think he's depressed, we've been noticing him just, he talks all the time about, I miss this friend or that friend, and he'll just have this like thousand yard stare, like he came back from the front lines or something, and he's just sitting on the steps and we're like, what's going on with you, bud? And he's just like, I'm just so tired. It's all the classical signs of depression from a 4-year-old, which is not what we expected, somebody who's normally so resilient.
Yeah, totally. My wife is a child psychiatrist.
Oh, well, there you go.
I won't speak for her, and she's not, she doesn't get into any of this stuff. She does her thing, it definitely has an impact. I mean, luckily kids are super resilient.
Right.
It's really interesting because I look at the kids and how they view all this too. It's like, they really are approaching this a lot better than adults are on balance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that they'll bounce back as well, that resiliency.
I think so too.
Yeah, yeah. But it's a good thing to be aware of. So what is going on with our musical entertainers right now? Like, that's got to be so hard. I know that you, as a person who does a number of events and concerts normally, right?
Yeah.
You're connected with a lot of these folks. You're a musician yourself and a performer, and a promoter. And also I there's just the venues, the independent venues. Like, give us a little bit of a window in how they're handling this and maybe how folks can help.
Yeah, sure. Well, so I'll break the answer down into three different groups of people, because they're sort of, you basically have the core three actually are audience, venue, and musician. The audience, but in this particular case, I'm going to go musician, venue, and then supporting infrastructure around that. So
yeah.
Promoters, sound engineers, stagehands. So
waitresses and waiters and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
Right?
Bartenders. All the security staff, side ops. I mean, everybody is associated with an event. So that's the thing about live music, is it's a really big industry. So the people who have it the worst by far are the venues. Imagine you have a business with extremely high overhead and extremely low profit margins. Your revenue goes to zero. Everybody's asking for refunds for money you were counting on having for your float, and you're probably not going to be opening up anytime this year.
Yeah.
I guarantee you, unless the government steps in and does something, we're going to lose them all. All of them. Oregon is made up of independent music. In fact, every single venue in Oregon is really unique. It's all independent music venues. And they are in deep, deep trouble. That's by far the people we have to worry about the most. If people look at the my JFL Presents page, or we can share it out through Canby Now podcast, there's a really simple form that people can go to. There's now a coalition of independent music venues across the country which are lobbying to the federal government for relief, because there's just no choice. It is the worst of all businesses to be in right now. So that's the worst. And then obviously the support staff, you know, who rely on a huge percentage of their annual income, you know, well above 50% of their annual income comes in 2 to 3 or 4 summer months, right? So that's all gone. So now you've got all the infrastructure companies around the business that don't have anything. And then you have the musicians. You know, the reality of it is on the musicians, most of the people who are doing this kind of stuff locally don't do it for a living. They're weekend warriors. The ones who do it for a living, obviously they're really feeling it.
Yeah,
I think the worst part of it is for, you know, if you are a musician who has managed to achieve your dream of making a living doing music, that's the biggest bummer here. It's like, it's so hard to get to the level where you get 100% of your income as a musician.
Yeah.
And yet people have achieved that. And so now that they finally got that dream, it's, you know, that industry is closed until further notice. And you know, people are trying to get into live streaming and that kind of stuff, and I applaud them. But the reality is, the financial model is not viable long term, and it's not the kind of experience to replace a live music experience. So, unfortunately, we are where we are.
Oh, that's so hard to fight that fight and to scrimp and scratch and finally make it. And then COVID's like, hey, you know, we've been waiting for you.
So, I mean, everybody involved in the ecosystem. I mean, honestly, the people who have it the best are essentially people who, like me, who is, you know, sort of a middleman. You know what I mean? Like, I'm in between, you know, I'm a, you know, sort of a part of the process, but I don't have a lot of overhead.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't want to paint a picture like this is okay. This is a financial nightmare for me.
Yeah.
So I don't, you know, let's make that clear. It's a complete nightmare. But by the same token, it's a widespread nightmare for a lot of people and for a lot of reasons.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about those independent owners that you mentioned first of the music venues, because you mentioned those low profit margins, right? We're not talking about folks with just, you know, hugely deep pockets and, you know, like multi-million dollar music agents or whatever that are just like, we can handle whatever. These are people that are usually do this as a passion, right? You know, they care about the arts and want to keep that alive and really depend on just every single event they need to keep things going, right?
Yeah, and it's also, there's an issue of cash flow. So, you know, like, I think I'm going to use restaurants as a really concrete example here, which is like a restaurant who the revenue they get this month is to pay last month's bills.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So the full stop nature of it, it hurts them right away. And you can't, you know, all of the PPP stuff, you know, the loans that the government's doing, regardless of what anybody thinks about that program, it doesn't solve anything for a venue because you can't open. So it's, you can't have payroll. I mean, none of that, the loan is worthless because you can't make payroll.
Right.
So it's like they you know, I don't want to wax philosophical about political stuff and what the government should or shouldn't do. I'm just telling you is if they don't get, if live music venues don't get relief from the government, they're fucking screwed.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I hear you on that. Well, now that we're all depressed and have, you know, just crying into our whiskey, let's talk hopefully a little more positive. Give us something hopeful to wrap things up here. What have you heard from fans, either of Hairfest or of other other venues, other events that you are a part of? How are folks handling this?
Yeah, and I think that's a great way to kind of look at this in a more positive light. I will say that let's use the Hairfest example. You know, one of the things that we're counting on is that most of the people aren't going to be asking for refunds because obviously we've been spending money to get ready for this year.
Yeah.
And if we have a run on everybody wants their tickets back, we got to go take money out of our, you know, personal checking accounts to try to cover that. And that would hurt, especially in a time when our businesses are at zero revenue. Joan's got her restaurant. I mean, it's just a, you know.
Yeah.
And people just overwhelming are like, we're keeping our tickets. We're behind you guys. You know, thank you. It's just like, it's been so heartwarming. And that, I think that extends across the music community at large. I think the people who are invested in live music in general have been extremely supportive of musicians. I know, you know, donating to live streams, buying merch. You know, they're doing what they can. And keeping in mind that the people who go to concerts, there's a pretty good chance that they're hurting financially too.
Yeah, right.
But I will say that the community spirit, the level of support and all that has been extremely encouraging. It's uplifting. And I think it really bodes well for the future of live music. I think that when we come back, it is going to be ridiculous in an awesome way.
Yeah.
So I'm excited about that. I think it's just building up demand. People are going to be excited for it and they're ready to come out when we can.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Love the optimism. So we will include a link to that petition where folks can support that thing you mentioned earlier to support independent music venues. Is there anything else that people who might be listening to this are like, what can I do to help? I don't want to see our venues go down. I don't want to see our entertainers not be able to entertain us, you know, on the other side of this. Any other way that just a Joe Blow who you know, might have a little bit of disposable income that they might otherwise spend on a concert could support this industry that's really hurting.
Yeah,
right now.
I would recommend that folks go to there's an organization called Music Portland. Also, I'll say, we'll through Cambie now. We'll provide a couple of links.
Yeah,
one at the musician level and one at the venue level to get out. And I think supporting those organizations, even with just signatures, even just by joining, you're adding economic muscle to those organizations. And believe it or not, even if you don't have a dime to spend, you can make a huge difference just by joining. It doesn't cost anything to join up with these organizations.
Mm.
All you're doing is adding your voice, and we're stronger with our numbers. So that's really helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, Jason. I really appreciate it. Anything that you would like to say before you go?
I just want to thank all the folks out in Cambie and across the region who have been so supportive of our event. Not only this year as we've had to come out with our announcement, but in all the years. You know, this is our 10th year. You don't get to 10 years without a lot of support from a lot of people. So, you know, just again, once again, expressing our gratitude and excitement for the fact that eventually we're going to get to do this again. And when we do, it's going to be one heck of a party.
Yeah. Cambie. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate having you on. As always, Jason, love your optimism, even in the midst of a difficult time. And also, you know, we're right now kind of having this reopening conversation. It's becoming more and more abundantly clear that even as things reopen, there's going to be a new normal, right? Like even eating out at a restaurant or going to get your haircut is going to look very different, at least for a long while. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I just love that your perspective, and I agree with you that, you know, when this can finally happen again, the concerts, you know, they may look different, but it sounds like it's going to be, you know, even better just because we had to suffer through this year. So I love hearing that.
I would, this is a little bit of a left field, but it's important for people to realize that no time in the history of the human race have this many scientists been working on a problem at one time. I mean, it's crazy the number of resources that are going into this, and I think that's the cause for optimism.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Jason.
Absolutely. Thanks again. Cheers.
Joining us once again on the Canby Now podcast is Derek Hill of Advantage Mortgage. He joins us on the line, of course. How are things in the industry right now with all the crazy stuff going on?
It's a little crazy, but not too crazy. I mean, we definitely have seen some things tighten up. Obviously, with any kind of uncertainty, banks tend to tighten their guidelines. So the great thing about being a broker is that even though some of our lenders are tightening up, we have others that aren't. We have a lot of lenders that are just status quo. They're like, hey, we still have all the same channels. We still have all the same credit score requirements. Interest rates may be a little bit higher because of the level of risk, but they're still funding loans. So actually March was one of the biggest months of our company's funding. So
wow.
we're still funding loans. There's still people out there buying. There's still people out there selling. We have to make sure that we're not, spreading the virus and whatnot, but yeah, everything's still moving along.
Well, so how can people get in touch with you right now?
The easiest way is just call the office, 503-266-5800, or send us an email, derek@findtheadvantage.com, but just call the office and we'd be happy to help.
Awesome. Thanks, Derek. Hang in there.
All right, you as well. Derek Hill, NMLS 50183, Equal Housing Opportunity.
All right. For our next segment, I have a couple of guests. Why don't you guys go ahead and introduce yourself to the listeners?
Sure. My name is Jason Facera, and I work with the Clackamas Soil and Water Conservation District.
And I'm John Runyon. I'm a principal with Cascade Environmental Group, a small consulting firm located in Portland. My work focuses on understanding watersheds, watershed restoration, water quality studies.
Wow. Thank you so much, Jason and John. Delighted to have you on the program. John, thank you for being much more detailed than Jason and explaining who you are. No, I'm just kidding. We are doing this interview via Zoom. How are you guys loving the Zoom lifestyle?
Getting used to it.
Yeah.
It's kind of the new normal, whichever tool we use.
Have you noticed we've all kind of become like lighting designers and sort of like much more interior designers than we used to be?
Well, I don't know. If you look at my background, it's not the right.
You're not quite there yet. Jason's got like some random boxes in the background, but
that's right.
John's got that nice that bare brick wall. That looks good back there. I like that. Good job.
Yeah, there you go. I constructed it today, so it looks good.
Very nice. So coming up this week, when people are listening to this, you guys are hosting a live presentation to share some of what you've been working on here in our local area for the past few months now. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure, John, would you like me to start?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the Clackamas Soil and Water Conservation District works with landowners in Clackamas County to do voluntary conservation on their land. And we received the opportunity to go after some grant money to really try to take an approach that we haven't taken before, and that's to focus on drinking water source quality and in a way that really impacts a lot of folks. We were excited to go in the Molalla area, and the opportunity to do it in the Molalla area really gave us a lot of excitement here at the office, because it's a group of folks that we work with to some degree, a lot of customers in that area, but there's also a lot of folks we haven't worked with and, around this drinking water issue that can maybe unite kind of some of the things that we do with some of the locals. I think that was a really great opportunity for us. So we received this grant to do this work, and we hired John and his group to do the bulk of the technical work, and they've done a fantastic job so far. And, he can really kind of explain what the assessment is. But really, we were doing this to reach out to people and to try to get more in tune with what's happening in the Molalla and Canby areas.
Absolutely. John, before we hear about more of your work and more of what you do, which I'm really interested in, Jason, I would love to just talk a little bit more about the background here in Canby. And even since we've been doing this podcast and local news for the past couple of years, we hear a lot of stuff about the quality of Canby's drinking water. I'm sure you have as well, especially in the summer. A lot of complaints, might be a way to put it instead of just concerns. But from from the perspective of Clackamas Soil and Water Conservation, you said you've been wanting to kind of dive into this area for a while. Is that kind of the reason, some of those concerns and some of the stuff you've been hearing?
You know, actually, it's not. I think, you know, and typically we work with rural folks. We work with rural and urban both, but our typical customer base has traditionally been rural.
Okay.
So, you know, we wanted to get in with producers and people who are, you know, growing things on their land or have some animals to just talk about like how to protect water quality. And protecting water quality, you know, part of that is protecting the drinking water source, but it's also, you know, helping them manage and steward their lands in a way that doesn't have downstream impacts. So for us, we wanted to, it's not that we haven't worked there, it's just that we wanted to get a better foothold and really be able to reach some folks to help make an impact for water quality. So it wasn't around the complaints or issues at all. It was more around, you know, having a good relationship with folks in that area, having them trust us as people they can come to for advice on how to be stewards and an opportunity for us to really kind of get into an area where, you know, we haven't built as much of a customer base as we'd like. And we do know that there are challenges out there with water quality, and this was a good way to tie kind of an important issue, the drinking water source. You know, with the municipalities are pulling, they're pulling that water from upstream. So us, you know, being able to talk to folks about how their management of their land impacts downstream is really important and one that we were excited to try to break into. So it wasn't complaint driven. It was actually a desire for us to want to go out there and work.
Cool. Awesome. Well, John, let's hear about your piece of this. I'm very interested to hear more about your expertise and work. Like you've kind of just heard, and you probably encountered it already in your work, kind of these complaints. People don't like the taste, sometimes the smell of the Cambie drinking water. And I understand just a tiny, tiny bit about how much maybe more complicated all of this stuff is around drinking water than we in the general public might realize. I think, you know, a lot of people, there's frustration. They're like, why can't they just fix it? You know, why don't you tell us a little bit about your expertise and kind of maybe what you've encountered, just a little taste, kind of what you're going to be talking about more this Wednesday.
So let me back up just a little bit and make it clear that we're looking at three water systems, three community water systems.
Yes, thank you.
And so starting at the lower end of the watershed, we're looking at Cambie. So there's an inlet to their water system there. It's really important to understand that we're looking at those inlets, and then we're looking upstream for there in terms of what might be affecting water quality. So that is Cambie.
Yeah.
And then next up the system on the Malala is the city of Malala, and they have an intake above the city. And those intakes essentially drain different areas. So if you look at Malala, it drains kind of a rural area, but really dominated by forestry above there. Mm-hmm. If you look at the area between the Malala intake and Cambie, the area that really influences the Cambie intake, there's a lot of rural residential. There's a lot of agricultural stuff going on. There's a smattering of forestry activities. So all of those are going on, and we're looking at those. And then finally, the third system that we're looking at is the community of Colton. And they have a very, very small water supply that is up on industrial and BLM forest land. Mm-hmm. And it's only like 3 square miles. So very small system there, less complex, obviously, than the other ones. So to answer your question about Cambie and some of the concerns that have arisen there, I've certainly read the newspapers and I've followed a lot of the comments around that. There's even a Facebook site.
Yep.
What is it? Cambie's drinking water stinks or something like that.
So I think you nailed it. Yeah.
Yeah. So trying to hear what folks are thinking out there, what the impressions are. And I have to say there have not been complaints in Malala. The complaints in Cambie are clearly, clearly related to algae growth in the river. And over the last couple of years, the algae growth has really taken off, and that creates compounds in the water, in very small quantities, can create sort of a musty odor and taste to the water. And I've actually had experience of this in my past because I used to live in Corvallis and they drew water from the Willamette, and they had the same issue every summer. When the algae would come on, the water would be musty and have kind of an off taste. And we always found that if we left it in the fridge for a while, put ice cubes in it, it was, you know, okay.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not saying that that's really what folks should do, but it's important to understand that essentially the constituents that are causing the musty odor are in very, very small quantities, and it's very difficult for the water system to clear out those constituents. They're not dangerous to people. They don't harm you in any way. It just creates a taste and odor thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the city of Cambie has looked at it in detail. They even had a consultant come in and look at what would be some engineering fixes so they could expand their treatment capacity to handle that. But it's extremely expensive to retrofit your facility so that you can deal with those compounds.
Mm.
So that's what's happening with Cambie, and I can talk about it in more detail if you like, in terms of, you know, what's it's generating, that sort of thing. But I see that as probably the biggest issue that we're facing right now in terms of current water quality. We're also looking ahead in terms of what might the future hold for water quality. And a future that's, you know, going to have more people moving into the Mooloolah, a future potentially that's going to be subject to climate change and all the impacts from that. And really our job is to look out into the future so that the community can prepare for that and come up with treatments, things like putting plants on to control erosion, other things out across the landscape that could be done that could really help with current water quality, but into the future too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's not dive too much more. Everything you said is, I think, folks that have been closely following this is a little bit of stuff we've heard before, but definitely great to hear it from an actual expert instead of just some random guy with a podcast or even some of our elected officials who know what they're talking about but don't have the expertise necessarily that you do. I would love to hear maybe a little bit more about the future or possible ways that you guys are looking at maybe helping or things that would help some of those water quality issues, particularly here in Cambie.
Sure. John, do you want me to talk a little bit about our role and kind of what some things we can do?
Yeah. If you could talk about that, that'd be great.
Yeah. So that's really kind of gets down to where the Soil and Water Conservation District can help. Once we finish this assessment and kind of figure out what our priorities are for doing some of this water quality work, we'll be able to go out into the community, into the rural area, and even in the urban areas to some degree, and talk to them about, you know, how do we keep the things that we can control, at least from a landscape level, how do we keep those things out of the water? How do we improve our management so that we don't exacerbate the situation with some of the management that can happen? So for instance, you know, maybe we can't do anything about climate change directly, but we can go in and do things like provide buffers on streams and plant vegetation that's going to filter out some of those pollutants that do, you know, cause issues, or that, you know, solar incidents on or basically sun shining on the water and heating it up, you know, more riparian vegetation, streamside vegetation will help to mitigate some of those things.
Yeah.
Keeping, you know, erosion down on farms and keeping manure from leaching into the water and causing, you know, nutrient blooms and algae blooms. So those are things we can control. And the district wanted to get into this project because not only are we able to pay for an assessment to look at this, we're able to then take that assessment, go back to the funders and say, look, we have a plan of what we'd like to do. We'd like to bring in money for people to be able to address some of these issues so that they're not having to do this on their own. It's not like we're saying, hey, you're the problem, go fix it.
Yeah.
We're gonna say, hey, here's the problem. We're going to bring you resources to try to help to fix this. And I think, you know, that's really where the power of the district comes in, is we have the ability to bring in grant money and technical expertise to solve these issues. And we can keep that water from getting dirty in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not all, you know, related to the rural lands. There's, you know, issues at highways, and there's issues in cities as well with, you know, overuse of herbicides and also people, you know, who dump in storm drains that, you know, aren't, you know, don't understand that goes straight to the water source. Those things, you know, those contribute as well. So we're trying across the gamut to really, you know, make some impacts and try to bring resources in so people can A, be educated about what their impacts are, and B, do something about it with some resources to go with it.
Yeah, yeah, I like that. And like you said, you know, John, you kind of mentioned some of the fixes that the city of Canby has looked at that end up being very expensive. And I believe I've heard that there's even not necessarily a guarantee that some of them would even help, you know, so we spend all this money and still have the issue. Really, I mean, on balance, like the way you put it, Jason, was great. It'd be better probably to just stop it from getting bad in the first place, right, rather than try to fix it on the back end. And then even folks that are downstream, you know, that may not have the resources or the money to do that fix are still in, you know, having issues up shit creek, as it were. So John and Jason, we do have something this Wednesday where you guys are going to be presenting some of these findings as you're continuing this study, right? And also a big part of this, you know, what was initially going to be an in-person thing in March has now gone virtual, as so many things have. But you're collecting input, right? Tell us a little bit more of kind of what you're looking for from people.
Sure. What we're trying to do is we're trying to kind of just give people an update of what we've found so far through John's work, and John maybe can expand on this a little bit if he wants, and then, you know, kind of give them an overview of what we're looking at, why we're looking at it, and some of the issues behind what we're doing, and then give them an opportunity to comment on what's important to them. So, you know, I know a lot of folks, you know, maybe some of the stuff that we'll present will be a little bit technical, and maybe things that they hadn't thought about, but we're actually just really interested on their level, what is their experience with the water that their drinking water is, or even folks upstream who don't directly drink the water, but who live on the watershed. Mm-hmm. What are the issues that are important to you? What do you see that you think is not right, or that could be fixed, or that could be changed? We want to hear from them, because I think, you know, it's great to hear from the municipalities and the agencies, but really, it's the people who live there every day that know what's happening in the community. They know what they want to see, you know, and what their concerns are as far as their health. They're the ones, you know, experiencing that. It's important to have them have the chance to talk and be heard. And we want to include that in the assessment for sure, in what we're presenting when we present this whole assessment when it's done. So we've got the technical, we've got kind of more of a public perception of what's going on. And we'll try to marry those to kind of come up with what really are the priorities for the basin. We don't want to just take the agency's word for the priorities. We want to hear from the public as well.
Mm-hmm. Anything you would add to that, John?
No, I think everything Jason said is absolutely right on. Watersheds are complex. Rivers are complex. There's lots of issues going on. And we want to make sure that we're capturing the key issues in the eyes of the public, of residents in the watershed. In some ways, they're the real experts out there because they live in the watershed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate you saying that, because I think there is also an element of folks that, you know, that this has become a little bit of these complaints and things have become a little bit of part of the scenery. You know, every summer we hear the same complaints, the same explanation about the algae comes and whatnot, and that it's too expensive to fix. And then the next year we do. I thank you for appreciating that this is important to a lot of people, and it's just objectively important. This is about health, and you know, a lot of restaurants and mm-hmm. industry rely on the water. Thank you guys for your work and just your interest in hearing from folks about this.
You bet. What's more fundamental than drinking water?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No, it's a good issue for us to wrap our heads around and really try to bring some value to the folks in the county. So it's very exciting for us as well.
Absolutely. Well, we have the details here that we'll share about where folks can, and we'll also have these in the show notes if you guys want to tune in, and if you can. But is there anything that either of you'd like to say before you go?
No, Tyler, thanks for the opportunity to come and talk on the podcast. We really appreciate that, and that you have the ear of folks that we want to come to the meeting and be a part of this. And we just look forward to being able to make a difference and come and bring some resources to the area and solve some issues if we can.
Absolutely. Well, John and Jason, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and your expertise. So this public web video meeting is going to happen via Zoom, which, as we've already talked about, you guys are very familiar with. We're on it now. It's going to be Wednesday, May 13th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. And we will include the meeting ID, the phone number if you just want to join by phone, and also the link in the show notes. Thank you guys again.
All right. Thanks, Tyler.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by the Wild Hair Saloon in Canby in Oregon City. The coronavirus has changed much about how the Wild Hair does business, but it has not changed the where, the why, or who they do it for. Owners Joan and Darren Monin, both lifelong Canby residents, are as committed to the community they love as they've ever been. Even as the service industry has been deeply impacted by the current public health situation, they continue to rally behind Canby, its people, and especially those most in need. We are so grateful for their continued support in this difficult time. As we've always said, the Wild Hair is a place where Canby goes to eat and have fun. That hasn't really changed. You just have to take your food and, you know, go eat it somewhere else. Until the governor's stay-home orders expire, the Wild Hair's friendly staff will be there to handle your carryout orders Monday through Friday from 11:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. They continue to offer their full menu of delicious food options, and they're doing a weekly meal deal that serves a family of four for only $25. Find the latest on their Facebook page, full menu available online at thewildhairsaloon.net. Give them a holler today at 503-651-4273.
The Canby Now podcast is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Franke. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden, so round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. Find more of her work at olivia13.com.
The Canby Now podcast is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The Canby Now podcast is a production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.